here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 68. Who are we? What do we do? A number of Seattle's film critics we gather in theaters multiple times throughout the week, except for this week, for some mysterious reason, just one screening here.
A daytimer at that, that almost nobody was at.
Yeah, seriously. So normally we have a discussion. It's usually quite fervent. And we bring this discussion to you in podcast form. So you have a chance to know what we, the critics, are thinking often. A relative short number of films to talk about this week, but we also have some other big happenings, such as Oscars.
Oscar nominations for this week.
Oscars to discuss. So we will chew the fat on that in just a bit. But I want to bring Steve Reeder and Sarah Michelle Fetters into the conversation here. Welcome all.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Adam.
Yeah.
Hello.
And Steve, why don't you just tear into this and give us a little idea about this first film here, Hostels, Christian Bale, right?
Yes. For those of us here in Seattle, it's kind of like one of the first really good films of 2018. But of course, it qualified for Oscar and other consideration because of its limited release in 2017. This is what you might call a kind of humane Western. Set in New Mexico and Colorado and Montana in 1892, written and directed by Scott Cooper, who gave us Black Mass, for example, and Crazy Heart, starring Christian Bale in what, for me, was a borderline Oscar-worthy performance as a very jaded, veteran, cynical, tortured army captain by the name of Joseph Blocker, ordered by his superior officer to escort a dying Indian chief, played by Wes Studi, beautifully and humanely so, on the road from New Mexico to his final resting place in Montana. And along the way, what you realize is that all the characters in this film, be it Christian Bale, be it Wes Studi, be it Rosamund Pike, be it Rory Calhoun, be it Timothy Chalamet, bit part, not quite as large as Call Me By Your Name, but he has a small role as well as the French character who does the cooking. Oh, we deal in stereotypes sometimes.
Who's in three potential Oscar-nominated films this year, two of which did get Oscar nominations.
Absolutely, Lady Bird being the third. But this is a beautifully calibrated, written, shot, and directed film about inner demons, about humanity, about finding what is common to all of us. We have not only the conflict between the white men represented by the army and the slaughter that has involved the Native American population for decades following the American Civil War, but it's also the kind of retribution and the kind of antagonism among the various Native American tribes themselves and among the various white settlers, ranchers, fur traders, and others. It's a constant moral, ethical, physical battle. It's a very dark film. It's a very thoughtful film. And ultimately, it's an extraordinarily humane film. I'm not the biggest fan of Westerns as a genre, but this one works on almost every count. I've seen it twice. I'm ready for a third go-round.
Really? See, now, I've heard a number of folks, I myself have not had a chance to see this one yet, but I've heard a number of folks kind of come in on this one, came in a little flat and felt that Christian Bale was doing the over-dramatic performance. Where does that sit with you, Steve?
Well, I would argue just the opposite. I think one of the strengths of his performance is how understated it is. I mean, this is a man who reads the histories of Julius Caesar and all the rest. I mean, this is a very thoughtful, non-stereotypical kind of character. He's, in his own way, even though you wouldn't think so on the surface, he's a very thoughtful man, obviously well-educated, obviously disgusted with what he's had to do over the years, obviously very good at what he has done over the years. And so I think it's a very subtle performance. I think that's the beauty of the film. There's a wonderful shot near the end, which I will not spoil for the listeners, but when he and company find their way to Montana, there is a glorious closing sequence to this film that summarizes it so well emotionally and psychologically.
I would agree with that. I also think this movie is such a brutal examination of racism and, you know, white privilege, if you will. And you're dealing with characters who have their eyes opened in a new way, and yet even when they think that they have grown, even when they think that they have come to think a new way, all of those sort of historical ingrained prejudices still rear their head. I mean, there's a point in the movie where we have a character who has basically lost everything, and the only thing the white characters can think to do to help this person is to take them away from their own history, from their own culture, from everything that makes them who they are. And they're thinking they're doing, to use your word, they think they are doing the humane thing.
The good thing, that's right.
But what they are doing is basically fundamentally erasing who he is and where he comes from without even realizing it. And that is why, I mean, for me, that is why I think this movie is so fantastic, because you can parallel that with so many things that are happening right now with these discussions in the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement and with stuff that we're talking about in regards to race and gender, wealth, everywhere, all of these conversations happening right now politically and socially, this movie subtly and almost insidiously is doing the same thing. And it, even though there is a success as far as what everybody is setting out to do, it's still a very depressing finale if you look at it in a certain light.
It's a film full of sacrifice of all kinds. And you come to realize that some of the good characters have life stories and histories and experiences, as you point out, Sarah, that are very close to the designated bad guys.
Yeah.
They have led very similar lives, done very similar things, have the same kind of life stories and histories, and they have to sort this out. Hence the title, Hostiles. It refers to the internal as well as the external for all of these characters. And by the way, it's just a beautiful representation of the American West.
Right. Completely agree. I mean, this movie is just geniusly shot. And you go and look at the way Cooper uses these locations and these vistas to sort of shine a light into areas of American history that we don't get to see very much. I feel like I haven't watched a Western like this in ages.
Absolutely. One final note, speaking of contemporary topics and issues in the world of art and film and entertainment, mm-hmm. I was very pleased to see, exceedingly pleased to see, that almost all of the Native American roles are taken by Native American actors, starting with Wes Studi.
Wow. So, Steve, you've seen it twice.
Twice.
You're talking a third go-around, so obviously for you, I'm going to say this is a theater. I'm correct
absolutely,
in this?
Absolutely, especially okay. with the widescreen cinematography. Absolutely.
Ooh, okay. And Sarah, how about you?
It's a theater, no question. I mean, it's a tough film, and not everybody's going to come away with the same feelings, but you're going to have a great debate and a great discussion afterwards. There's a lot of food for thought here.
Right, right. Okay, moving along. Next up on our slate for discussion, Den of Thieves. This is another film that it met the chopping block for me. I looked at it and I kind of went, okay.
It's a January film.
This is correct.
Yeah.
So give us the skinny, the 411 on this one.
It is the B-grade heat you've always wanted.
Mm.
No, I mean,
but aren't there a lot of films that are already the B-grade heat?
There are. And what's funny is we've started, so it's 2 years in a row now that we've basically started with the B-movie version of 1995's Heat.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we had 999. That movie, though, was made by John Hillcoat, and it had a pretty extraordinary cast, and it aspired to greatness.
Mm-hmm.
I am not quite sure that Christian Gudegast, he's the writer behind London Has Fallen and A Man Apart. This is his feature-length directorial debut. I am not sure he is aiming for Michael Mann status with this film.
Uh-huh.
I think he is just kind of having a good time slumming around in themes and ideas that Michael Mann would be proud to have called his own, but would bring a lot more depth and maturity to. Basically, it's your stereotypical cops and robbers film. You have Los Angeles Sheriff's Department detective Big Nick O'Brien, played by Gerard Butler. He's the head of the Major Crimes Unit Task Force. He and his group have to take down a former Marine named Ray Merriman, played by Pablo Schreiber.
Which group are the regulators? And
the
which
regulators are the sheriffs.
Oh, okay.
And the outlaws guys, are yes. the outlaws.
Okay.
It is a shame that we have a movie where the law enforcement people call themselves regulators, and nobody in the entire movie ever says, "Regulators, mount up!"
Yeah.
I was waiting for it, and it never happens. I was very sad about this.
Mm.
In the middle of it, you have a character named Donnie Wilson, who's played by O'Shea Jackson Jr., and if you saw Straight Outta Compton, he got to play his dad, Ice Cube, in that movie. He made a heck of an impression in that film. He's very, very good in another movie that he from last year that he made with Aubrey Plaza called Ingrid Goes West. Really good in that film as well. And he is outstanding here in a movie that is not really outstanding in any other way. There is fun to be had in watching Gerard Butler basically do a coked out version of Al Pacino, which, I mean, even down to the leather jacket and the swagger and the dysfunctional marriage. And He is just having a blast sauntering through this film and chewing up as much scenery as he can. And there are a couple really amazing shootouts that you can tell. I mean, this is an action writer mm-hmm. who got his, who, you know, who learned his chops sitting on other action films. So, it, you know, these sequences are really well staged, but this movie is so unrelentingly stupid. Mm. And other than O'Shea Jackson, I have trouble coming up with anything to say that I think is recommendable about it. Mm. I mean, if you are a Gerard Butler watching him slum fan, I mean, if you're somebody that goes out and watches everything that Gerard Butler does, you are going to have a good time watching Gerard Butler at his most Gerard Butlerist. Mm. Otherwise, it's a long 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah. Steve, you and I had a discussion the day after, and you were telling me there were a lot of storylines and plot lines that just kind of begin but then never resolve.
And then disappear. I don't want to say stupid, but they're just pointless. They are plot pointless in this particular case. The attempt to open up the Gerard Butler's character story by introducing his estranged wife and the kids and having him show up drunk. No, that never works, and it's never resolved. It's never carried through. We have a couple of scenes, and then we move on. There are other attempts to open up the story and give it more of a kind of a social context and all the rest. Doesn't work. We drop the plot points. Here's where I would perhaps be equally unkind, as you were momentarily there, Sarah. The attempts at humor, for the most part, I thought were humorless. There's nothing worse than attempting to lighten or leaven a serious, violent story with humor that doesn't work, that is kind of stupid and unmemorable. And also, for an action director, the final climactic shootout I found incredibly lame and uninspired. Nothing really happens at the end. And so there are just a lot of plot points. What the movie tries to do, the one strength of the movie, and it got me interested for about 20 minutes, were the two parallel stories. How the regulators are planning to stop the perpetrators if they can figure out what they're going to do and where they're going to hit it and how they're going to hit it, and what the perpetrators were up to. That part was interesting. But once they actually engaged each other, it quickly lost interest. So it's a January film, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. So... all things being as they are you even giving this a rental, or is this just a skip altogether, or where do you two come in on this?
Late night cable or satellite once it starts making the rounds, which should be in just a few months.
Okay, so
although it did surprisingly well last week at the box office, so that was a little bit shocking to me. You know, yeah, I am a skip. I'm trying to come up with a reason not to be a skip, because I actually do think the final shootout is reasonably well staged. And I actually like the heist that happens at the Federal Reserve. I think that is also really well staged until you start thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheer stupidity of how certain characters, not the thieves, but certain other characters react to what's going on, I just couldn't take it anymore. But the staging of it, I thought, was nice.
Mm-hmm.
I also think... There's an M. Night Shyamalan-like twist just for the sake of having one that isn't ever earned.
Hmm. So, Sarah, you're falling into the skip category. Steve, you're saying late night television. That also, in kind of my book, that falls into skip category as well, because we're not shelling out money.
Yes.
So, okay.
Generally, a skip. It's a movie that invites the question, really?
Yeah.
A lot.
Okay. All right. So there was another film that came out last week that you and I actually saw, Steve, next to each other, and I think the reaction was a little bit different, and that's 12 Strong. And this is a film based on actual events that happened shortly after 9/11. It's a number of special forces teams that were deployed to Afghanistan on this secret mission that was up until recently kind of this unknown thing. It was Operation Dagger. And then at the time, would-be Captain Mitch Nelson, who is Chris Hemsworth in this case, imagine Thor, going to lead a group of 12, or actually himself leading a group of 12, to infiltrate the war-torn country of Afghanistan. He's basically got to get in, gain the support and the backing of the Afghan warlord, General Dostum, and then learn to cripple the Taliban with the help of the warlord, and then... I guess, inflict some of the most terrible losses that the Taliban had actually seen up until recent day. That was one of the more embarrassing losses that they'd had. And so this is sort of a recounting of their political jousting and the battles and all the glaiven, all of that rolled in together into one.
And to do it in a country where invading forces had never done this, never accomplished this.
Right. Afghanistan being like the destroyer of empires.
Yeah, and to do it right before winter sets in, mm-hmm. where once winter set in, they would never be able to finish what they were starting, and they would suddenly be dug into a 3-year quagmire.
Right. So, and they're
which
doing
is
this,
ironic.
Right. They're doing this in a 3-week period, which exactly it was. They were given 6, had to do it in 3, and then you're right. The snows would settle in, and
it was supposed to be impossible.
Right. But they made the impossible possible. It's a rah rah sis boom bah. Drink the Kool-Aid. Here we go, Army. Go yah, hurrah, or something along those lines. That's Marines, but.
Do you think there's an irony, though, in that this is a movie about a great success in Afghanistan, about doing something quickly and doing something with intelligence, doing something with diplomacy, and doing something that nobody had ever done before,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's a movie that's about a war that is
still
going on.
And there's that, not to be lost on that point. It is brought up, and I thought this was a little on the nose, and it becomes didactic towards the end when General Dostum is saying, this is just the beginning of the war, there will be much more to come, basically. And it really is sort of the, if we didn't know what we know now, the foreshadowing of the war that will just keep going and going and going, that we're still fighting.
Well, he goes even further, remember. The general says not only that, he says, you Americans, you may think you're the heroes now,
mm-hmm.
but eventually you will be the hated ones.
Mm-hmm.
Don't imagine that you can rest on your laurels or that this is the end or that this is the final judgment of the Afghan people on your intervention here. You too will become the hated ones over time, as indeed.
And that's not on the nose at all.
Oh. Well, and that was actually kind of my bigger beef with this is it's kind of like, from where I sit on the whole engagement we've had there, we kind of know that. I don't need this film to then go ahead and lay it out for me one more time.
Well, it's a very odd movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, on one level, it is an actual sort of rousing mm-hmm. real life war film
mm-hmm.
With that treats this military unit with respect and intelligence and shows them actually as a working unit, even though you don't get to know all of the characters as well as you maybe would like to, you do believe them as this group of fighting men who would live and die and do anything for one another.
Exactly. And they believe in the cause.
Yeah. But then there's also this sort of layer of jingoism that it almost plays like a recruitment video.
Yeah.
And then this stuff near the end gets tossed in to basically just remind us that we're still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if the movie can't decide, are we a recruitment video for the army?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we sort of a nuanced piece discussing about the complicated nature of this war? And it's really frustrating.
And I think the disappointing thing is I don't think it's intelligent enough to be a very... I don't think it has the capability of talking intelligently about this war as much as it would like to.
Not when you throw in, I mean, there's an Al-Qaeda villain in this movie. So there's a great scene early on before mm-hmm. the team actually leaves for Afghanistan where one of the team members is looking at videos of what Al-Qaeda and the Taliban do in Afghanistan. And it's very effective and it's very subtle. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, I get it. Yeah.
These are
bad guys. We need to go there and take care of this. And then moments later, we are introduced to our villain of the piece, who is something out of a Rambo movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, I'm not. He might even be too horrible for a Rambo movie. Maybe this is Mission Impossible. I mean, this is the guy is so over the top in his utter sadism.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unnecessary. We remember what happened on 9/11. We know what the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were capable of. We don't need this extra level of sensationalism that's something out of an exploitation movie mm-hmm. to have this hammered home. It's pointless. And if anything, it just takes us right out of the movie.
Yeah. What I will say is the film does a pretty graphic depiction of what's actually going on. We're given some pretty fantastic cinematography throughout the entire film, really making New Mexico look a lot like Afghanistan and in a pretty worn, torn, brutal way. I was rather impressed with the way they came up with some of the war scenes. I do have some question about the editing that comes into play because I'm like, didn't we already see those rockets leave that missile launcher? And you see it happen 3 more times. But still, I thought that was pretty well thought out as far as the actual battle sequences went.
I would tend to agree with that. In fact, I would make a couple of points. Number one, having kind of poo-pooed the big climax to Den of Thieves, I will say the cavalry charge near the end of this film, it's not quite at the level of Lawrence of Arabia, mind you, but it's very effectively done with some exceedingly good use, I think, of overhead cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really effective and really quite exciting. I would agree that some of the themes and characters are taken, you know, in extremis. The Taliban leader was almost becoming comical in terms of the overplaying. But I will say this much, in fairness, given the nature of this film and what it's trying to accomplish and how it's trying to calibrate the story, but not always getting in the groove, Hemsworth does come across as a bona fide movie star.
Yes.
On a purely gut, visceral level, he comes across like a commander for a guy who had never, you know, actually seen action in the field before. Mm-hmm. He's a movie star. He's charismatic. I believed him, and I think he really gives a successful performance. And one other thought, Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
I got a question for you when you're done here.
Michael Shannon, I don't care what movie he's in, this man scares me.
Yes.
Yeah. And sometimes it's really, really effective. And here, he comes across as someone you don't want to meet on the battlefield.
No.
Yeah.
I got to ask you both a question. I agree. Hemsworth is actually really good here. And I've liked Chris Hemsworth for a long time, so it doesn't really shock me that I like him so much in this movie. Michael Shannon, same thing. How badly do you want to watch just some sort of lazy Glenn Ford, Jimmy Stewart kind of Western with Chris Hemsworth and Michael Shannon just going around the range, roping cows and not really doing anything other than just talking to one another? I think that would be amazing.
I think that would be a fun next 310 to Yuma, if you will.
There you go.
So theater rent skip for you guys.
Oh, I would say rent.
Okay.
I'm barely a rent. I mean, it's not as outrageously xenophobic as 13 Hours was, but there's a lot that hasn't sat well with me. So I'm still a rent, but not a strong one.
Right. And I fall into the rental category as well. So three rentals from the Squabblers on 12 Strong. We got one more that actually came our way. Maze Runner. This finishes out the trilogy.
It does. Maze Runner, the death cure. It's the final installment in James Dasher's best-selling young adult trilogy. It's been a little bit long in coming. Director Wes Ball has he's directed all three of the films in this series. This one took a little bit longer than they were expecting to hit theaters, mainly because star Dylan O'Brien tried to kill himself on set. There's a stunt involving a train, and apparently it didn't go so well. And so this movie got delayed for almost a year because he had to heal. He had to make another film. It took him a long time to get back to where this movie was put on hold so he could heal. In this installment, Thomas, our hero, he was the one that led the group out of the maze. They're fighting Wicked, that evil corporation that is trying to use something in their brains or in their blood or whatever to stop the virus that is destroying the world. Thomas knows that this is wrong, and he wants to expose Wicked for the bad guys that they are, but he also wants to rescue his friends. He wants to go back and get in there. Wicked has captured Minho, played by King Hong Lee. They need to get in there, rescue him, destroy Wicked, and take their band of surviving young adults and children who had been in all of the various mazes to a secluded island where they will hopefully be able to live and, you know, the virus will burn itself out and they can restart civilization.
This is an ambitious project from start to finish.
It is.
And they're shoehorning an awful lot into a 2 hour and what, 10,
2
15,
hours and 20 minutes? 2 hours yeah, and 22 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It is the longest of the three. It also wraps everything up. And 20th Century Fox didn't split it into two chapters, which, thank you.
Yeah.
Same time, there's a lot going on in this movie. T.S. Nolan's screenplay cannot fit everything that's happening inside this movie into one narrative. It's absolutely impossible. And the most glaring thing is that we have our relationship between Thomas and Teresa, K.S. Scardellaro. She left with Wicked at the end of the second film, believing that, you know what, they're right. We have to die to save the world. Their relationship, their love, their whatever you want to call it, is kind of the core of how things work. And yet, the movie is so all over the map and there's so much going on, their actual relationship never gets a chance to really blossom in a way that is effective. It's just the emotions never come through. What I will say is Wes Ball, through these three films, has shown himself to be a very imaginative action director. He stages things in a way that is continually fascinating. And there is actual tension throughout this movie. I was interested to see how things were going to wrap themselves up. I was never bored. It's not up there with, say, like The Hunger Games, even though that movie made a major mistake in splitting up its final chapter. This series has never comes close to reaching those heights. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it. I still had a good time with it, even with the year off that they had to take before they could finish the film. I will say, I think it's fairly obvious Wes Ball must have watched Mad Max Fury Road during their break.
There's a lot of practical.
Because there's a lot of practical car stuff that's going. I'm surprised only Dylan O'Brien got hurt making this movie, because the stuntmen should have got extra pay for this one.
I concur with you on the stuntmen factor, but I will say this, in about the middle of Act Two, I did start to reach my burnout point and was kind of thinking to myself, going, oh, please, how do we bring this cow into the barn? This one's getting a little long in the tooth. I want to go home. And I actually kind of thought to myself about partway through Act Two, I'm like, all right, on to the next young adult. Come on. This is just, come on. I'm going to have to sit in the category and just say, it was fine. I'm not impressed by a whole lot of what I saw. It just kind of goes through the motions. I need something new. That's where I'm sitting on this. Steve, where do you come in?
I have not seen it.
Oh, what?
But I'm impressed by YA fatigue.
Okay. Well, good. Then I'm not alone. All right.
Hey, I'd much rather watch this than another Twilight or Insurgent movie, a Divergent movie.
Well, we'll get 50 Shades Freed here in a couple
but that's
weeks
not
yet.
Young, that's not a YA movie.
Well, on the surface. The films could convince me of otherwise. I haven't seen a whole lot of racy in those films to begin with.
Well, they did start out as Twilight fan fiction.
Right? See, that's just it. So, Sarah, what's ultimately your take on this?
It's actually a light theater. I mean, if I'm being honest, I'm going to tell you that it's more of a rental.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a fan of these films, you need to see how it ends. And I think this movie's effective. I mean, even with all my issues and reservations, I think it's effective for what it sets out to do. So I'm a very, very, like, go to the $6 matinee before noon theater.
Waiting for the crest. Okay. And yeah. I am a rental altogether. I'm not even going to say even begin to shell out your hard-earned money. If you can, if you have a free ticket, or if you have Movie Pass or something like that, that gets you in for free, low.
So unlike, say, Paddington 2, nobody is remembering this one by next year's Oscars.
No, not a chance. Speaking of which, there are a lot of films that we've kind of had discussions of over the year.
Yep.
A lot of them did make it into the Oscar discussion here. Oscar nominations out
this
now. There were a few surprises and a few things that maybe even got left off. I, for one, a little surprised we didn't see a showing of Wonder Woman in anything.
That's surprising. I mean, Wonder Woman not getting in anywhere is surprising.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can be shocked that it didn't get in for Best Picture or Screenplay or, Gal Gadot for Best Actress. I mean, I don't think you can be as shocked in those categories.
Right.
I think back in the day, if we're talking, the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, Wonder Woman would have got in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a space there for films like Wonder Woman and Jaws and Star Wars, and those big spectacle, Dr. Doolittle, which was horrible, but it was a Best Picture nominee.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that the voting has changed, the fact that you need 5% of the first place votes to actually get on the ballot, the fact that it's between 5 and 10 nominees that there can be, the fact that voters, this is the other thing, voters only list 5 films on their ballot, even though there are up to 10 that can get nominated.
Yeah. This year we see 9.
And so, yeah, and I don't think you will, if this year, in a year where you have movies like The Big Sick and The Florida Project and I, Tonya that are huge industry favorites, mm-hmm. if those movies can't get 5%, mm-hmm. to round this out to a 10, mm-hmm. I don't actually think we will, under these rules, I don't think you'll actually ever see 10 nominees.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's possible. I think Wonder Woman could have snuck in had people been allowed to vote for 10 films, because then they would have felt like, okay, now there's room for me to sit there and say, I'm going to give Wonder Woman this spot mm-hmm. because I can vote for 9 other films.
Yeah.
I also think that films like The Florida Project, I, Tonya, and The Big Sick, which did have lots of fans, mm-hmm. I think they cannibalized one another.
Yeah.
Because they could not get to that 5% marker because most of their fans were probably the same people.
You know, and I think there was a lot of money that was poured in behind those as well. So not only do they have their fans, but The Big Sick, I, Tonya, even Mudbound. Those are three that came into the discussion that I saw a tremendous amount of marketing dollar behind. And Steve, you and I have received a ton of mailers, not only through our union, SAG-AFTRA, but then also through Seattle Film Critics Society, the various different mailers that have come our way. Get Out was another one that was a tremendous amount of money poured behind.
Sure.
And so...
Well, and that's the thing with Wonder Woman. Warner Brothers did put a tremendous amount of money. They tried. And I am shocked that Wonder Woman did not get into like costumes or production design or sound mm-hmm. or some of the other technical categories.
Yeah.
That actually surprises me because a movie that is such a cultural phenomenon mm-hmm. didn't break through with in those categories. That legitimately surprises me. It doesn't surprise me as far as like Best Picture and Best Actress.
And not only a cultural phenomenon, but look, we are overwhelmed by the wealth of franchise and graphic novel and superhero movies these days. You would expect at some point that the movies that stand out from year to year, and it clearly stood out in my mind in that genre for calendar 2017, it would score some nominations.
But Logan becomes the first superhero film to receive a nomination in one of the major categories. It was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay and deserved it. Mm. So it's not like the Academy had this year didn't notice. Now, I think it would have been great had Logan had a chance for Best Picture. I think it would have been great had Patrick Stewart had a chance for Best Supporting Actor. And you can say the same thing about Chris Pine for Wonder Woman. It would have been great had he had a chance to get in for that film. But I do think the Academy is starting to look at these films in a different light now.
Yeah.
It's just going to still take them some time.
So, Steve, do you think that this may be then the year for the little films that could, in one way, shape, or form? If we're not seeing these monster films, we're seeing perhaps the smaller Three Billboards, for example?
I think so. And I define little films that could probably more broadly than Sarah does. For example, when I saw Three Billboards the first time, I knew it was getting good buzz.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like the tidal wave that has, sort of grown in the past 3 to 4 months around this film. But if you think about Get Out, which is not the kind of genre film that normally gets a lot of Academy Award, Oscar buzz, or love. When you think about Lady Bird, even, a story like that. I mean, it's a beautiful thing that we're getting that kind of variety and diversity this year, because I was really impressed how 2017 gave us so much quality across the spectrum of genres, types, and styles of film. But I'm impressed that they are getting nominated as much as possible. I know Sarah and I are both impressed that both Jordan Peele and...
Greta Gerwig
are nominated in effect in multiple categories.
3 nominations each.
Yes, for relatively little films that could and did and did so beautifully. It's a very good sign, I think. And I'm always pleased about that because when I see a film like, well, Mudbound is a relatively big budget film. We can talk philosophically how it slots into all this as a Netflix release. But when you talk about films like Moonlight last year and others, I'm pleased to see that they're rising to the top, that we're recognizing quality, that we don't have to make a lot of noise. It doesn't really bother me so much, the marketing you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's about the quality. Mm-hmm. Does it deserve it?
Although Mudbound was made for just under $20 million, so it's not like a huge budget.
That's a modest budget.
Yeah.
Well, it's on my short list of the five best of the year, but I'm an outlier in that regard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
But Mudbound is one of the interesting things about this year. When I made my predictions, I did not predict Mudbound in any category.
Yeah.
And I did it because there has been a consistent, strong Netflix bias in the Academy.
Bias against Netflix?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And I would agree. I would agree because I fall into that, actually.
Yeah. And so I was thinking that was going to continue. So Mudbound actually is a breakthrough for Netflix. The fact that it didn't get nominated for Best Picture, it's sad. I feel bad for it. The fact that Dee Reese didn't get into the Best Director category, that's sad. I feel bad for her. But the fact that Mudbound not just got nominated in a category, got nominated in major categories.
And in multiple categories.
Supporting actress, screenplay, the first ever nomination to a woman in the best cinematography.
Rachel Morrison, absolutely.
Yes. And
well
deserved it.
Absolutely.
This is huge for Netflix. And it's also, it is the beginning of a sea change, I think, for the industry as a whole.
I was going to say, is this the watershed moment then?
Yeah,
is this where we start to see things turn around where it's no longer the big companies and now,
well,
I mean, Netflix is a big company.
It's a big company.
But it's
they're
no
financing
longer
100+ million Martin Scorsese film.
But you see what I mean. It's not 20th Century Fox. It's not Universal. It's not Paramount. It's Netflix.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it is a watershed moment. And it sets the stage for Scorsese next year in a very big way. Mm-hmm. If Mudbound can break in, then a gangster movie with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Joe Pesci directed by Scorsese made for over $100 million that is mostly going to be seen on a streaming platform. Mm-hmm. The Academy, if they're doing this for Mudbound, there is no way the Academy can ignore that next year. I want to bring up so you said Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele joins Warren Beatty and James L. Brooks.
That's a short list.
Yeah.
That's exalted company.
As the only guy in his first film to be nominated for director, picture, and screenplay. And both Beatty and Brooks, those were adapted screenplays.
Wow.
This is an original. And Greta Gerwig joins that list too. Technically, this is her second directorial offering, but she also is nominated for picture, director, and screenplay for an original screenplay, and only the fifth woman in history to be nominated for Best Director. And it's also the first time out of that five where it is a female-driven motion picture that is, you know, not some period piece. And not, I mean, you can make a case that Jane Campion's The Piano is relatively female driven, but there's a lot of other things going on in this movie. This is a movie about a mother-daughter relationship, and that's it.
So I want to ask you too, because a couple years ago it was Oscar So White.
Yeah.
This year we're looking at, it's for the women. Is there a filter or a lens that we're not seeing here that you might be picking up on that might be the criticism that people have? Oh, this year isn't such and such, or it isn't that and that.
Well, this is a year of Me Too and Time's Up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you can really, I don't think James Franco missed because of the Me Too and Time's Up movement. I don't think it helped. That story pretty much broke while people were in the middle of voting. Mm-hmm. So I think you can make a case that Denzel Washington was probably going to get James Franco's spot based on that all happening anyways.
Sure.
But it didn't help him. But there is a level of hypocrisy there at the same time in that, you know, Gary Oldman is Gary Oldman. He's genius. He's one of the greatest actors of the past 3-4 decades. But he has his own skeletons in the closet in regards to some pretty damning news and regarding, you know, he and his wife. I mean, it's ironic that he and Leslie Manville are nominated in the same year. She's his ex-wife and she's got stories she could tell.
and but maybe she will.
Yeah. I mean, and they also nominated Kobe Bryant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got an animated short that is up for an Oscar. And Kobe Bryant has a very long history as far as all of this is concerned. So there is a level of hypocrisy as far as, you know, we're gonna say, no, James Franco, you're not getting in. The Weinstein Company, every movie that they put out didn't get any nominations this year. You know, but we've still got Oldman. Mm-hmm. We've still got we've got Kobe. Mm-hmm. And Kobe's animated film, which isn't very good, could easily win.
Interesting. Steve and Sarah, I want to ask both of you this following question here, because people are asking me, and I'm giving them two answers. And they're saying, all right, there's 9 films nominated for Best Picture. What's Best Picture? Who should I be? What should I go see? What should I go see right now? I've said go see Shape of Water, and I've said go see Three Billboards. Those are the two that I'm telling people to go see. If you were put on the spot right now, Steve, what would you say for folks? Got to go see these two.
Okay, I can't argue with that, Adam, but I'm going to repeat what I told you about 2 weeks ago. One of the movies I've seen twice is Phantom Thread.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily persuade me right now that is the best picture that I have seen in the past year. That is a beautiful, subtle, exquisite period piece from Paul Thomas Anderson. Everything about it speaks to intelligence and taste, and it has a glorious score by Johnny Greenwood. I mean, everything about it is perfectly calibrated from start to finish. The shifting of relationships and the balance of power among the three main characters is really subtle, really intelligent. It's a wonderful adult film and a period piece. And to my mind, there's your dark horse, in my mind. I'm not saying it's going to win, but that's my dark horse. I'd say go see Phantom Thread, especially if it turns out to be Day-Lewis' last movie.
Sure.
I think you are right with it being a dark horse. This was a movie that the only nomination that people were confident in was Daniel Day-Lewis getting nominated for Best Actor. People kind of thought it was going to get nominated for costume design as well, but it wasn't a guarantee. This film ended up with six key nominations. When it came out late in the year, voters didn't have a lot of time to see it, and they obviously responded.
Mm-hmm.
When you have films like The Shape of Water, which is basically a fantasy love horror movie,
And paranoid Cold War thriller.
Yeah. And you have a movie like Three Billboards, which is under attack for some of its racial underpinnings. Phantom Thread could be a very easy secondary vote where you say, oh, yeah, you know what? I think I'm going to go there instead. I kind of love this movie. Phantom Thread is definitely one that I would tell people to go out and see right away. Uh-huh. I would also tell people to go see Lady Bird, because if you haven't seen it yet, you really need to see it. It's terrific. Call Me By Your Name also. I mean,
okay, well, we could get into
I think if you have to go see two, go see Phantom Thread and go see Lady Bird.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to repeat the ones that you said.
All right. Well, I think that gives us a fair round out of the ones that folks can see. And I noticed that SIFF Cinema still had a number. I think SIFF had Lady Bird and...
They've got Call Me By Your Name, Lady Bird, I, Tanya... Yeah. They've got a huge collection over there, and Shape of Water starts at the Cinerama today on Friday.
Ooh,
for a week, and the Cinerama is going to do their right before they show Black Panther for that week before Black Panther, they're going to show the other eight nominees.
Mm. Wow, so lots of opportunity. We all know that the bowl that used to be so super is not going to be so super for most of us here in Seattle.
Man.
So maybe a good time to get out into the theaters in the next 2 weeks and really kind of just soak in all of the cinematic glory, right?
A little cinematic cramming here before Oscars night in early March.
And there's a lot that's really good out there. Go see it.
Yeah. So in quick review of the films we talked about today, 12 Strong getting... three rental recommendations from The Squabblers, Den of Thieves getting two skips, Hostels getting two theater recommendations, and Maze Runner, kind of splitting the difference. We got a theater and a rental in that category. Do want to ask, Steve, you work on any other projects at this point?
Not at this point, no. Okay. I'm just preparing to do a complete breakdown of the Oscars once we actually learn the winners, because I'm fascinated by the way we've got the young and the old, an extraordinary diversity in terms of nominees, some holdovers, some newbies, some Roger Deakins who are desperately trying to win just once.
Yeah, come
just
on. Once, please. Come on. Yeah. And Sarah, how about you?
I have an Oscar response piece that's going to be going up either later tonight or tomorrow morning. I'm also hoping, there's a good word. I'm also hoping to interview the one and only Eddie Muller in the next couple weeks to talk about Noir City over at the Egyptian.
Well, that will make two of us.
So, yes.
The Tsar of Noir is back with us.
This will be a fantastic lineup. We were discussing that earlier a couple days ago, Steve.
Absolutely. We've got the classy A's and the trashy B's. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, the Maltese Falcon being in there.
Maltese Falcon and Mildred Pierce. Mm. And what is it, The Big Sleep?
The Big Sleep.
I think is included in this. Oh,
and Kiss Me Deadly. You have to see Kiss Me Deadly.
Ralph Meeker, thank you very much.
Cloris Leachman in one of her first roles.
So, yes, the film noir that we can all be hopefully discussing in further detail not too distant from now. This has been Cinema Squabble, episode number 68. Thank you so much for joining us. Sarah Michelle Fetters, Steve Reeder, I'm Adam Gerke, and thanks much to Sprint Sarbagast, our producer.